This is a recording of the special hearing on electioneering communication held by the Federal Election Commission on October 17th and 18th, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Convene the Federal Election Commission's meeting of October 18th, 2007. We are conducting a hearing on the implication of the Supreme Court's decision in the Wisconsin Right to Life decision. We have reached our afternoon panel today, and we have four people who've come to testify to before us. We have Stephen Horsting from the Center for Competitive Politics. We have John Sullivan from the Service Employees International Union, Heidi Abig, representing the American Taxpayers Association, and Michael Booz from Citizens United. Welcome all. The procedure we have been following here has been to permit each of you a 5-minute opening statement. There is a light display box in front of you. The green light will be on at the beginning of your comments, and with 1 minute left, the green light will begin to flash. With 30 seconds left, the yellow light will come on, and the red light appears at the point at which your 5 minutes have expired. After that, we will turn to questions from the commissioners. We are not following any particular order up here. Commissioners will simply seek recognition and ask questions and can ask follow-up questions as well. It's produced a good dialogue as we've sort of gone through these hearings up until now. In terms of your presentation, we have generally followed a practice of having our speakers present their opening statements alphabetically, which means, Ms. Abig, you would be the first to go, followed by Mr. Booz, Mr. Horsting, and unfortunately, Mr. Sullivan, you would be the last, although it may advantage you in the end. And so unless you have worked out an arrangement among yourselves otherwise, that would be how we would suggest proceeding. Certainly, also just to be clear, the general counsel and the staff director's representative, Mr. Biersack, are also free to ask questions as we continue with this. All of that having been said, Ms. Abig, please proceed at your convenience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and members of the Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of both the American Taxpayers Alliance and Americans for Limited Government. As noted in the written comments, both ATA and ALG are Section 501c4 organizations. Both organizations educate the public and take positions on issues that generate strong and often adverse reactions from the government and the public. Donors to both organizations highly value the ability to contribute to an organization that espouses positions and advocates change on controversial issues while remaining free from disclosure with its attendant risk of threats, harassment, and reprisal from those who disagree with its position on issues. ATA and ALG submit that there are two principles that the Commission should have in mind when promulgating final regulations. One, my clients want to stress that attacking or condemning ideas or issues is not the same thing as commenting on or attacking a candidate. Issues and candidates are not so intertwined and synonymous that an attack on one per se becomes an attack on the other. Without the ability to condemn an officeholder's position on an issue, citizens lose the right to hold their officials accountable for their actions. The good old days of Congress adjourning long before an election seem to be over. Thus, citizens need to be able to condemn their officeholders precisely when they are taking votes that affect them, even if it is shortly before an election. As the Supreme Court has stated, in a representative democracy such as this, these branches of government act on behalf of the people, and to a very large extent, the whole concept of representation depends upon the ability of the people to make their wishes known to their representatives. Two, the Commission should be as mindful of the right to privacy as it is of the public's right to know through disclosure. How is an exempt electioneering communication ad any different than an anonymous pamphleteer speaking using a megaphone? There has been little talk about McIntyre, NAACP versus Alabama, and other cases upholding the right to privacy and one's political associations and beliefs. While it may be easy for the Commission to simply say disclose, it turns Wisconsin Right to Life into a hollow victory for many nonprofits. Many donors to my clients value their anonymity and will not give if they know that their identities will be disclosed, because they have been subjected in the past to reprisal and other manifestations of public hostility. And like in the cases I just cited, there is no compelling interest here requiring disclosure. Disclosure here has been likened to disclosure under the lobbying statute, but the interests are different. The Supreme Court upheld the reporting requirements under the Federal Regulation of Lobbying Act and U.S. versus Harris. The court said that the compelling interest was to maintain the integrity of a basic governmental process and to allow Congress the power of self-protection. I think that both Harris and Buckley can be read to distinguish reporting requirements from those directly involved in or impacting the governmental processes, as opposed to regulating those who are indirectly attempting to change the climate of public opinion. Even when a federal regulation on public policy advocacy involves merely disclosure and not a prohibition on speech, the regulation undergoes rigorous constitutional scrutiny because, as the Buckley Court recognized, the deterrent effects on the exercise of First Amendment rights may arise as an unintended but inevitable result of the government's conduct in requiring disclosure. The strict test established in NAACP versus Alabama is necessary because compelled disclosure has the potential for substantially infringing First Amendment rights. But there has to be governmental interest sufficiently important to outweigh the possibility of an infringement. Additionally, there has been a long-standing tradition in our democracy of anonymous public speech. There is no important or compelling government interest here in requiring disclosure of communications that the Supreme Court has said are not express advocacy or its functional equivalent. The types of ads which the Supreme Court has stated are not electioneering communications, do not have a substantial connection to the governmental interest in lobbying regulation recognized by the Harris Court, the governmental interest in preventing corruption in its appearance recognized by the Buckley Court, or the governmental interest in regulating electoral speech recognized by the McConnell Court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Booz?
Chairman Leonard, members of the Commission, my name is Michael Bowes, and I am the Vice President and General Counsel of Citizens United, a conservative grassroots advocacy organization with more than 250,000 members. Citizens United is a major producer and distributor of documentary films. We have spent in excess of $1 million annually to produce and market documentary films to our members and the public at large. Our films deal primarily with contemporary public affairs issues and often include footage, interviews, and other references to public officials and candidates. Since the issuance of Advisory Opinion 2004-30, Citizens United has actively urged the Commission to adopt a rule exempting advertising for movies, books, plays, and similar works from the definition of electioneering communications. We have consistently sought recognition for these ads under the news media exemption because the underlying works fall within the scope of that exemption. But we were mindful that movie advertising might fall under more than one exemption category. Thus, I am here today to urge the Commission to adopt Alternative 2. We believe Alternative 2 is fully consistent with Chief Justice Roberts' controlling opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life 2 and the Commission's authority to promulgate rules implementing the underlying statute. On the other hand, we view Alternative 1 as falling well short of the Supreme Court's instructions. The Chief Justice's opinion is far-reaching. It focuses on the absence of a compelling justification for regulating ads that do not contain express advocacy or its functional equivalent. Alternative 1 does not cure this infirmity because it still leaves intact the burdensome disclosure and reporting scheme that applies to electioneering communications. Alternative 2, however, cures the infirmity because it exempts qualifying ads from the regulatory scheme altogether. While Wisconsin Right to Life 2 dealt directly with grassroots advertising, the decision has significant implications for other types of ads as well, including broadcast ads for products or services such as documentary films. We know that because, number one, the Chief Justice stated explicitly in footnote 10 of his opinion that the court was applying the same analysis to Wisconsin Right to Life's ads that it would have applied had the group been a commercial entity. And two, In the context of campaign finance regulation, the court has consistently applied strict scrutiny analysis to regulations of speech by commercial advertisers. Thus, in our view, the Commission is correct to include the proposed exemption for ads for products and services within the scope of the pending rulemaking. Wisconsin Right to Life 2 also has implications for some of the Commission's other rules, especially those defining express advocacy. Many of us in the regulated community have long believed that the definition of expressly advocating is far too broad to withstand First Amendment scrutiny, and the Chief Justice's opinion confirms our position. Express advocacy requires the use of so-called magic words which expressly call for the election or defeat of a candidate. Contextual considerations are irrelevant to the analysis. Citizens United therefore calls on the Commission to modify its definition of expressly advocating by deleting those parts of the definition that look beyond the four corners of the words and phrases used in the communication. In the past, the Commission has resisted requests that it define terminology promote, support, attack, or oppose, which has come to be known by the acronym PASO. In light of the decision in Wisconsin Right to Life 2, we urge the Commission to revisit that issue and adopt a rule that defines PASO as a communication that is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. Finally, although we strongly support Alternative 2, we cannot support the proposed safe harbors that would apply irrespective of which alternative is adopted. As drafted, they are far too narrow to be of any significant benefit to the regulated community. We are especially concerned with the ordinary course of business prong that would cover ads for products and services, but we also have strong reservations over the third and fourth prongs of the safe harbor test as well. With respect to the ordinary course of business standard, it is an inherently subjective standard. It's one that we've run afoul of with respect to Advisory Opinion 2004-30. It's one that stopped us from being able to run legitimate ads for our film Celsius 4111. Our concern is that standard is inherently subjective and can easily be manipulated to obtain a desired result. And second, such a standard is inconsistent with the Chief Justice's admonition that the lawfulness of an advertisement cannot turn on factors outside the four corners of the advertisement itself. Once again, I thank you for the opportunity to speak before the Commission on these important issues, and I look forward to answering any questions that you might care to ask.
Thank you. Chairman Lenhard, Vice Chairman Mason, Commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to testify on your electioneering communications hearing. Before I begin, let me just commend the staff for what I just have to know is a very difficult NPRM. I looked at that thing and I can only imagine the number of hours that went into that, so it's really impressive. My colleagues on this panel say that Chief Justice Roberts was more amending a definition than construing a prohibition. They also say that once we concede that the ad in question is a genuine issue ad, there's no governmental interest or jurisprudential basis for compelling its disclosure. They also say that it would be absurd to have organizations Congress never intended to run ECs all of a sudden have to start reporting its electioneering communications. And of course, my colleagues are absolutely right on each of those courses, each of those points. But correct as they are, it would be untenable for the Commission to invoke its administrative authority to stay application of Section 201, a facially valid provision, without some organization asserting that application of 201 violates the rights of speech and association. It would be unseemly for that question to be litigated in the posture of an agency defending its administrative prerogatives, I say this respectfully, with no factual background of a speaker who is actually chilled. The Commission should therefore hold its nose and apply Section 201 to issue advocates, even as doing so is a backdoor to some of the grassroots lobbying disclosure measures Congress recently rejected. For the record, I'm very much against those measures. If you Google me, you'll find that out. The word contributors, by the way, in Section 201 subpart F, should guide the Commission in crafting disclosure requirements, even if disclosure comes down harder on nonprofit organizations whose ads are funded by contributors than it would for for-profit corporations. Hopefully, some organization will sue you for applying Section 201 to their speech activities, and we can once and for all resolve what could have been a companion issue in WRTL 2. I don't say that lightly. I know that chill is real, and I know that suing the government is very expensive and difficult. Expenditures and electioneering communications are mutually exclusive concepts in federal campaign law for the most part. So it's imperative, as you've heard before, that the Commission not conflate express advocacy with its functional equivalent. Therefore, the Commission should repeal its definition of express advocacy at 100.22b and remove references to reasonableness in Part A. Now, some may suggest I'm urging restraint in one area and activism in another. Not at all. The unity in my testimony is the case or controversy doctrine. Section 202 remains facially valid. It was not challenged in WRTL 2. Similarly, revisiting the gloss on core FICA terms like expenditure or political committee was not before the court in McConnell. In fact, the McConnell court said that the gloss on FICA is and remains the gloss of Buckley, even if that gloss is not constitutionally required for new congressional enactments, and even if that gloss struck the McConnell court as functionally meaningless. The line of cases from Buckley, MCFL, through McConnell shows that express advocacy is and always was a magic words test. This issue is res judicata, and repealing 100.22b is an administrative decision that almost no district judge would overturn. By the way, the McConnell court itself.
And to the degree that such a judge exists, they're probably in the D.C. Circuit.
Precisely. Footnote, the McConnell court itself recognized, then denigrated, the magic word strictures of express advocacy to justify Congress's needs for electioneering communications. So reasonableness is out with regard to express advocacy. Unfortunately, it remains for its functional equivalent. The Chief Justice's use of the term charges you at some point in the analysis chain to make a hard judgment call about which ads are in and which ads are out. I regret that's the case, but it is. In that event, please confine your analysis to the text of the ad, as the opinion mentions, and if at all possible, recognize that the tie goes to the speaker, as you've heard several times this week. By the way, a couple of other issues. A non-exhaustive list of examples in safe harbors is a good thing, in our opinion. And I believe that while none of the sample ads mentioned in the NPRM are express advocacy, the Yellowtail ad and the Keen ads are the functional equivalent. I look forward to taking your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chairman,
members of the Commission, I am a participant in a joint project along with counsel for the AFL, NEA, and AFSCME in presenting comments to you on this issue. All of our organizations are very active in the area of issue advocacy. We spend a tremendous amount of resources on federal legislative activity and state legislative activity. We also spend a tremendous amount of our members' voluntary contributions on political activities. So the issues raised in these rulemakings are critical to us and our members. Yesterday, the chairman commented that Mr. Bob observed in his presentation that he filed a lawsuit to get an exemption from the electioneering communications ban for a group of ads and ended up getting a redefinition of electioneering communications. We would submit that the court did not simply redefine what constitutes electioneering communications. Rather, it redefined, or perhaps clarified, the constitutional limits on the Commission's ability to limit, or in the court's view, criminalize speech. Last year, a number of the commenters in this rulemaking, including the unions who are a part of this joint comment, filed a petition with the Commission seeking a rule crafting a narrow exception for their grassroots lobbying efforts from the Commission's regulations concerning electioneering communications. We have returned to the Commission not to ask again for that exception, but to argue that the controlling opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life 2 requires the Commission to revise its regulations in light of the redefinition of the boundaries limiting the Commission's power to ban and punish speech. Such revisions not only require an examination of the electioneering communication regulations, which is the subject of this proceeding, but must also include the definition of express advocacy itself, as well as other regulations which have a direct impact on speech, including the Commission's coordinated communication regulations and allocation regulations. As the last speaker, I have the advantage of relying upon the presentations of numerous commenters who have outlined the issues and share our belief that the decision in Wisconsin Right to Life 2 changes in a fundamental way the Commission must recognize and accommodate protected speech. Let me take just a few moments, however, to reiterate points made in Larry Gold and Jessica Robinson's presentations. Larry Gold emphasized that the Commission should adopt option 2 as an approach which best accommodates the decision in Wisconsin Right to Life with the existing regulatory regime on electionary communications. Larry also discussed the potential application of option 1 to labor unions, particularly with respect to the reporting and disclosure requirements. Now, he began from the analysis that it's important to make a distinction between a donation and dues. And this is a very important point for unions. Members pay dues to unions not to finance electioneering communications, but to finance and support the full range of activities that the union engages in, from collective bargaining representation to servicing members to engaging in advocacy, both with their employers and with state and local officials around the country. And it would be, if not counterproductive, at least serving no particular purpose to report or disclose the names of people who did in fact not contribute to the financing of a particular electioneering communication. And I think several commenters talked about the lack of a public policy benefit for having a list of members whose dues were used or may have been used to finance these communications. Jessica, in her comments, talked about the proposed safe harbor and expressed our concerns both with respect to the narrowness of the safe harbor, but also with respect to our concern that an individual or group failing to meet the requirements of the safe harbor may suffer from a presumption that their speech is in fact not protected. She argued, and I think the Commission acknowledges that when you don't meet the safe harbor, the Commission is then obligated to demonstrate that the communication in question is not susceptible or susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. Now, in response to that, I think it was Vice Chairman Toner raised the troubling question of how do you prove a negative? And in fact, the constitutional safeguard itself is framed in the negative. But the question really is, who better to put the burden on? The speaker, who may be forced to tailor the scope of their communication because of a fear of going over a line, or the Commission, who has the burden to demonstrate that, in fact, the speech in question falls outside the protections of the First Amendment? I see my time's expired. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, very good. Questions? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Horsting, you said that we should do alternative one and require disclosure because the disclosure provision is on the books and wasn't affected by the decision, but and disclosure requirements have been upheld in the McConnell case. But didn't the McConnell case uphold the disclosure requirements for ads which were the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and therefore when the Supreme Court now in a subsequent decision has said that issue ads are not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, isn't that a clear indication to us that the disclosure requirements do not apply?
The first two predicates of your question are absolutely true. Yes, the McConnell Court said that ads can be subject to disclosure to the extent of the functional equivalent. That's what I take from the opinion anyway. But in terms of the next case, and I think there has to be a next case, it's my opinion, I'll just speak frankly, you're going to be sued by somebody. And I think it is better that you not go in as an administrative agency defending its administrative authority in the posture of this case. I think it's against a reformer who would urge you to be even more regulatory, or against potential plaintiffs on the Hill, former sponsors of the legislation, who would urge you to go even further. I think it's important that the case have an actual plaintiff who is saying, I am chilled in my rights of speech and association. And that's a far better basis for the case to go forward. Under administrative procedures, you've got a very high burden. Immediately a court's going to go, a judge is going to say, especially an unfriendly one, wait a second, I thought McConnell's facially valid. It's facially validated. Excuse me, I'm having trouble speaking today. I apologize, Commissioner. I thought that the McConnell court said 201 is facially valid. So under your administrative authority, why are you carving this out? Because of some future as-applied challenge you're prognosticating? The first line in WRTL 2 is Section 203 says, and then here's another interesting point. After WRTL 2, you have from plaintiff Wisconsin Right to Life, same counsel, Mr. Jim Bopp, who settled WRTL 3 and also settled Christian Civic League of Maine. And my understanding of those opinions is, I don't have them committed to memory entirely, is that it says the prohibition is unconstitutional. The prohibition is unconstitutional in both of those cases. So that's my take on this, and that's my position on this. Do I agree that I won't waste much breath on this, but do I think there's any constitutional basis for compelling disclosure of genuine issue advocacy? No, not for a minute. That's why I work for CCP.
Okay. Other questions, thoughts? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Booz, to go from constitutional theories down to practicalities for you, when you're looking at the language that we've set out in the NPRM for this business commercial exemption, which would apply to what Citizens United does, I mean, you've made it pretty clear you think the second prong, which is made in ordinary course of business, needs to come out because that didn't fit your organization when it was first putting together these documentaries. But on the third prong, about not mentioning any election candidacy, political party, et cetera, I mean, how do you think that needs to be changed? My understanding is that also would be a problem for you because of the fact that you might produce a documentary or film that does mention candidates or has information about candidates. Does that just need to come out entirely, in your opinion, or is there a way of changing that language to bring the kind of work that your organization does within the safe harbor?
Well, our organizational position is that the safe harbors would be unnecessary if the appropriate action were to be taken to redefine express advocacy and to define PASO, because the way we look at it, that the safe harbors really don't provide anyone with much of anything. As they're currently constituted, only the ads that are most obviously not electioneering communications would fall within the safe harbor. Well, they're obvious to begin with, even without the safe harbor. We think that particular provision that prohibits the mention of elections or political parties, etc., that ought to come out completely. Basically, what we would, if you were to adopt a safe harbor, you're only looking at perhaps the first prong of the safe harbor as being something that would be acceptable, and that would be essentially that it would be exclusively devoted to advertising the product or the service. That's not much of a definition of safe harbor either, and we think that if that's the only definition that you're left with, you might as well have no definition whatsoever with respect to a safe harbor. It's just unnecessary, we think, if, one, you define express advocacy to only encompass magic words. You define functional equivalent as basically being that language that is not susceptible of any other reasonable interpretation except aimed at influencing an election. Independent expenditures fall under express advocacy standard. Electioneering communications encompass the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And when you have that standard there, and when you set it there at that point, it then becomes clear that if you're advertising a product or service, and that product or service might be a book about a political candidate, that that ad is, in fact, not an electioneering communication. And let me give a good example. If you recall, during the last election cycle, Michael Moore had these advertisements for Fahrenheit 9/11 that really made President Bush look ridiculous when he was on the golf course. I'm concerned that under the safe harbor standards that have been set forth here, that ad would be illegal, or at least it would not fall within the safe harbor, even though it was a legitimate ad that sold a lot, that convinced a lot of people to go see his movie. I mean, it performed the task at hand, which was to get people to see the movie. It may have had some effects on the election, but you can't look at the cause and effects standards because the Supreme Court has said you can't look at that. By the same token, we had some advertisements for Celsius 4111 that really had some very bland references in our ads to President Bush and Senator Kerry. It was the two of them speaking on how they would react to terrorist attacks on the United States. And the distinction between their statements was very subtle. One said they would be proactive and one said they would be reactive. And we had those two statements in our ads as initially put together. We had to take them out because they made references to a to the candidates, period. And so trying to draw those distinctions is very, very difficult. And safe harbors, I don't think it's possible to set forth a safe harbor. We think under a legitimate rule, our ads would have been permissible back in 2004. Michael Moore's ads would have been permissible back in 2004. And if you redefine PASO, or if you actually define PASO with the definition set forth in the Supreme Court's ruling of functional equivalent of express advocacy, and then narrow that definition of express advocacy, you've taken care of the problem with respect to the need for safe harbors.
Okay. Other question? Chairman Toner?
Oh, it's catching. Well, that's all right. I just hope former Commissioner Toner isn't insulted. I'm certainly not. I wanted to follow up on the safe harbors as well. And first, just to note, Ms. Abegg, in your testimony, I appreciate that you brought out this series of questions about character qualifications and fitness for office. It seems to have bothered you, all those questions. Is that right?
Well, it did, and probably because I can imagine my clients calling me with exactly those questions. Why can't we say that?
Well,
a lot of them want to criticize or praise an office holder.
Well, it bothered me too, and I'm the one who wrote those questions and suggested they be put into the NPRM because I thought those questions were implicated if we were talking about character qualifications, fitness for office. It was exactly that kind of thing. And I read this morning from the brief of your former boss, Mr. Bopp, where he proposed that standard to the court and where the court repeated that back in its opinion. And so just one point about this is that this standard wasn't invented by us, wasn't proposed by us, but rather was proposed by Mr. Bopp and was adopted, or at least was incorporated in the language of the opinion. And that, frankly, is why we have the problem that we have. Now, given that we would look at things like that for the safe harbor, I understand Mr. Bose's position on the safe harbor, but you and Mr. Sullivan both criticize the safe harbor as being too narrow. And I wonder if either of you have a suggestion about a way it could be rewritten to make it useful.
The suggestion that I made in our comments was just to make sure that it was clear to the regulated community that those safe harbor provisions are not exclusive, that you could still meet the safe harbor even if your ad doesn't fall within that. And I didn't think the language in the proposed draft was strong enough or made that clear enough.
and you were not alone in that, and that certainly, but it was it was certainly our intention that we would have an overarching rule, and then there would be within that rule a safe harbor, which would provide a greater degree of clarity as how we were interpreting that rule. And obviously we were not clear enough that that's analytically how we were approaching the problem, but we will try and fix that.
Because I realize there's no way probably to draft a safe harbor that incorporates all of those concerns I listed in my comments.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of the coin, as I mentioned a little earlier today with the other panel, was that we didn't want to end up with a safe harbor that was broader than the rule in certain circumstances, you know, where there were communications that met the safe harbor but were also could be interpreted only as a call to vote for or against a candidate. That would obviously produce a nonsensical result, and so we sort of had to struggle our way through that those choices. Yes?
Yes. I sort of began the process of thinking about a response to the notice of proposed rulemaking, particularly on the issue of safe harbor, wondering, well, doesn't a safe harbor, in a sense, turn the court's analysis on its head? Does the safe harbor say, okay, you can speak if you satisfy these requirements? And I was wondering, just as a point of departure for the commission, whether or not it served a better purpose to have the commission identify those factors it would consider in terms of whether it was protected or not protected. Sort of, ultimately, the commission has the burden of demonstrating that the speech in question is not protected, therefore subject to its regulations. And in making that analysis, it can legitimately look at certain factors. And in our comments, we tried to outline what those factors were. So rather than articulating a safe harbor, which imposes a burden upon the speaker, we thought that the best approach would be to outline those factors in which the board could consider in making a determination regarding the speech, whether or not we outline them in our comments. But the concept of a safe harbor, I think, itself raised some concerns. In looking at the actual safe harbor articulated by the commission in its notice, we felt that it was entirely too restrictive in terms of the kinds of speech that we believe was protected by the court's decision.
I just want to follow up on the factor issue, because one of the other things that bothers me about the opinion is that it says at one point you have to avoid the hurly-burly of factors. And it goes on in the next paragraph and lays out a 4-prong, 11-factor test for how we're to do this. And so, you know, I don't quite understand, you know, it's either a bright line test or it's a multi-factor balancing test. And those two really aren't the same. And so, you know, while the desire for clarity in terms of being able to look down and sort of, you know, tick off a list or whatever to advise a client, I understand, but that's a very different kind of a test or an issue than a bright line test. And I particularly am concerned, or just have a question, if we start listing factors, what does that mean? In other words, does it mean that you have to meet all of the factors or any one of them? And if it's not one of those extremes, then we're into one of these multi-factor balancing tests that just isn't a bright line under anybody's standard. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, the list of factors, I think, would not be exclusive. I would imagine through adjudications, the commission would add to those factors and going forward. So I think the listing of factors or the describing of factors that the commission will say, well, we will not base a decision that this speech is not protected on the fact that the speaker is a supporter or opponent of the candidate. We will not base a decision on the nature of this communication based upon its timing with respect to an election or legislative session or the scheduling of a vote on that issue. We will not base a finding that it's not protected on the basis of whether the communication has reference to a website, which may itself contain express advocacy. These are all very useful items for a person crafting a communication to consider. So if they say, okay, well, it's okay for me to issue this communication even though the vote was held last week, or that the motion or the legislation hasn't been tabled or sent back to committee, I can still talk about it because the commission has told me that dependency of the vote is not a factor they will consider in determining whether or not this communication is subject to its rules. And I think that is a helpful exercise. And essentially that is what an advocate does when they look at a body of case law. They'll look at the factors. They'll try to advise their client. And given we're in the middle of a rulemaking, I think the commission has the opportunity to sort of catalog for the regulated community those factors it will consider and will not consider in making its determination on whether or not the speech is protected.
If I can follow up on that, I mean, this is a struggle for me, right? Because we have, as I see it, probably more than three choices, but at least three choices. One, we can simply promulgate Chief Justice Roberts' test in the regs and say no more. And my sense is that that would be, some of you think that that would be the best path, and lawyers can make whatever judgments they want from it, and at a minimum it will convey to the outside world that we've read the Supreme Court's decision and we're aware that it exists. The second thing we can do is we can do one of these sort of factor analyses, and in some cases say we will never, ever in enforcement consider relevant some number of things. And that will provide some comfort for people because they know they can put those things in their ads and that won't harm them. The other side of it is what we would consider relevant is harder because there will presumably be some ads which could include one of those factors that would not be could be construed as something other than a call to vote for or against a candidate. So we will have to have some vagueness in the weight, relevance, importance of it. And so you would, but we would tell you these are the kinds of things we might be thinking about as we read your ads. But it won't provide much in the way of real clarity or comfort. You'll again be left with sort of trying to guess where we are. And the third choice is to provide a safe harbor where we sort of say, if the ad says this, we will not enforce. Right now, you can say other things, and maybe won't force too. But we can assure you that there is at least four, somewhere between four and five or six commissioners who believe that this is entirely protected speech, not as broad as all the protected speech. We know this kind of speech, and for people who want to be completely safe, they at least know that if we say this or something like this, we're off scot-free. And then if we have more risk, we could say other things, and our lawyers can sort of try and guess where the FEC is. And that's sort of my conception of what the safe harbor does, that it provides a certain zone of complete protection from enforcement. And what I understand a number of people here saying is far better that we do the first, which is the vaguest of articulations of what we intend to enforce against, or the second, which provides a little bit of clarity, but not much real clarity about what we're enforcing and what we're not. But that probably the worst choice for us to do would be to choose the third choice unless it really came pretty close to being as expansive a safe harbor as the rule itself, so that people really knew the outer boundaries of what they could speak, and therefore we wouldn't really be chilling anything because the safe harbor would be as close to the rule itself as we could get. And I know from having roamed the halls and trying to find four votes on so many issues over the last 2 years, that is very, very hard to do, both conceptually because it's very hard to understand how we would provide a lot of clarity in a very concrete way to what I think the Chief Justice presented is a very close to a vague test, although certainly it is constitutionally not vague, but very close to a vague test of what reasonably can be construed. And because there's so many different ways speech can present itself and so many different issues and so we're struggling through. So I just want to try and frame this and make sure I'm as clear that I really understand where folks are on this and that there really is I sense a near consensus that we do best by saying the least here and leaving what I would argue is the greatest degree of ambiguity about what kinds of cases we're going to be pursuing in enforcement and those that we're not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes. I'm willing to be the first contrarian to some extent. I think that I do worry about safe harbors becoming the default standard and that being the starting point of any enforcement matter or advisory opinion request. I do worry about that. On the other hand, I do think that the regulated community needs, especially the uninitiated, and they do exist because thankfully they're not all in this room because they have lives, which is a good thing. They need examples. They need safe harbors perhaps, but they do need as much guidance as they can so that they can look to the rules or perhaps the E&J and get some idea of what ads they could do. Now, Heidi's point is well taken, and it's one I share, that the list should be non-exhaustive. So I tend to favor Articulating the standard, which, by the way, the test is as you know, no reasonable interpretation other than. That's the test. It's not so much the 4 and then the 11. That's my understanding of that is that's Chief Justice applying his test to the particular ads in WRTL. But I think you should put into the ENJ the examples of every ad, the ones under Wisconsin Right to Life and the ones under Christian Civic League of Maine that you've already conceded fit under WRTL 2. Put those into the ENJ and give as much idea of the factors you'll look at. And I am not so sure that I'm for the third option as you framed it, which is carving out the safe harbor. I'm more for the second.
Yeah, we're clearly for the first option because and clearly against the third option and our, as we've articulated before, the third option has the problem of it, as was articulated, becoming a default rule, or at least from the viewpoint of the regulated community. People that look at these safe harbors will say, anything outside the safe harbor, you're at risk. And I don't know of any lawyers out there, with the exception of possibly me, who would offer advice to go outside the safe harbors. I mean, I would look at the safe harbors and I would say these safe harbors are just that. They're the most narrow, obvious cases. But if you list examples, at least examples provide a little bit of information. But the safe harbors I just view as being dangerous, and maybe in part because I deal with the IRS with respect to their safe harbor provisions at times. And, of course, they don't even go as far as what's being proposed here with their safe harbors. Their safe harbors just create a presumption, and they even go so far as to say, we can overcome the presumption, so even if you abide by our safe harbors, you still might be in trouble. But I'm just very leery of safe harbors, and maybe it in part because of the experience in dealing with the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay. Anybody else? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
We have our problems, but we're not the IRS. Mr. Ebbing, I'd like to ask you a question, and it's related to what Mr. Horsting said earlier, which, Mr. Horsting, if I could summarize your view, I think it's that I mean, you think, from a constitutional standpoint, alternative two is best, but you're recommending alternative one because you think procedurally it puts us in the best position in litigation in the courts.
That's half of what I said. There's no question. What I'm saying is you're staring facial validity in the eyes, and you have no as-applied challenge anywhere on 201. It's just not. You just don't have it.
Well, I wonder how that, Ms. Abeg, is affected, in your opinion, by the line of cases that you raised. And, you know, only a couple of people have raised these line of cases. And that is, most of the commenters have said to us, well, when we're looking at the disclosure requirements, you just need to apply the campaign finance cases, you know, Buckley, McConnell, to the concept of disclosure and what's required under the statute. And most of the commenters want to ignore the issue that you've brought up, which is, I believe, now that the court in Wisconsin Right to Life has said these are not electoral ads, these are issue ads, therefore you have a different line of jurisprudence that comes in, and those are the cases of the, you know, the Watchtower, Bilotti, et cetera, and those cases apply, I believe, a standard of strict scrutiny because of the issues that you've raised about, you know, possible harassment and other issues. Does that other line of jurisprudence, these other cases, apply in such a manner that they overcome the procedural and litigation issues that Mr. Horsting raises?
I believe so, and I guess I would disagree with Stephen. And I would award the tie to the speaker and not require another nonprofit to spend a lot of money bringing another lawsuit to challenge the disclosure provisions. The government should bear that, and we should presume that that speech is not regulated.
Okay. Do you want to follow up on that? Okay. I've got a separate topic I want to talk about very briefly, which is the degree to which we can consider the context in which an ad appears. Because a couple of you, and I think it was Mr. Bowes and Mr. Horsting, although I'm not sure, said that either context is irrelevant or that we have to limit ourselves to the text of the ad. And the problem that presents for me and is that it's often impossible to understand the meaning of words without the context in which they appear. And my sense of the court's decision is that they're not asking us to do exactly that, of ignore anything other than the text of the ads, but not to draw in context other than those things which we reasonably could discern without intrusive discovery. And the example I used the other day, because it amused me, was the and a small number of other people were in the room at the time, but you weren't there, I don't think, so I can tell the joke again. was the example of the expression "Yay Yankees." An expression, the meaning of which is very different depending upon whether you're on a subway train going into the Bronx in September or if you're at the parking lot in Stone Mountain, Georgia at Confederate Remembrance Day. And the context of that speech is dramatically, it changes the meaning of it dramatically. The other one I thought of, Randy Moss is the one versus Nixon is the one, right? I mean, because we know something outside of the text of that speech about who Randy Moss is and Richard Nixon is, those two expressions, those two statements have dramatically different meaning to us. And so we have to, I think, and I don't think the court would stop us from drawing some context, And yet there certainly, we had crossed the line in Wisconsin Right to Life in the court's mind. And so I guess my question to you is what sort of context can we take into account? Must we truly, ignore all knowledge outside of what is provided in the ads, or are the limitations more on the means by which or the extent to which we go in search of discovering what I think the court saw as improper, which was the purpose or intent of the speaker? It's a jump off for anybody who'd like.
Sure. The way I like to analyze it is that I think the commission goes too far with 100.22B, and then that looks at too many things outside the context of the words themselves. But I think if you look at the language at 100.22A, that might be appropriate language. The language we're asking that would be removed from the definition of express advocacy, that might be appropriate language in which to define the functional equivalent of express advocacy, where the communication in context can have no other reasonable meaning than to urge the election or defeat of one or more clearly identified candidates. It's when you look at the communication with reference to external events such as the proximity to the election that you really get into trouble, because that's precisely what I think the Chief Justice said you can't look at it at all, or issues such as the proximity of the election. On the other hand, where if you use words such as Nixon's the one, that's not express advocacy, but I think it would be the functional equivalent of express advocacy if it was done on an ad referring to Richard Nixon and the election itself. So it's a subtle difference, and I think the commission itself has had trouble distinguishing between communications that fall within the latter part of 100.22A and 100.22B. An example I like to raise is the Swift Vets ads. I think that had the Swift Vets conciliation agreement been entered into after this decision, there probably would have been a lot more doubt as to whether their ads were express advocacy or not. I don't think those ads constituted express advocacy under what set forth in Wisconsin Right to Life. I think they were the functional equivalent and were legitimately and properly reported as electioneering communications. Now, I know there were other issues in that case where there may have been some express advocacy and solicitations in that matter, but that's sort of the distinction, and it's not a very easy distinction to make between the language in 100.22A and 100.22B, but I think that's an area where you might want to start.
Mr. Horsting.
Yeah, First of all, my understanding of epistemology is that truth is objective, not relative, but it's always contextual. It just is. So I empathize with what you're saying. And when the test is no reasonable person, no reasonable interpretation other than, you've put the word reasonable into that. So while I think a four corners test is what you should be looking at, and it's very easy to do with regard to type A express advocacy, a four corners test, you're looking for certain words. When you're doing the no reasonable interpretation other test, you are permitted to look at the contextual meaning of those words. What you're not permitted to do is you're not permitted to probe intent and effect. And that begins to get into the types of evidence you can and cannot entertain. And this is what the court was talking about. It's talking about injunction mode, where the court has to very quickly determine, can these guys speak or can they not? And they're not going to pull in experts and go, what do you think will be the aggregate effect of this ad on the voting populace if they were to hear this? That's not the type of thing you're allowed to determine. But I'll do a rough Fergatch analogy because I can't really think of anything else right now. If you say, don't let them do it, and the only reasonable meaning of that is you've got to vote the guy out of office, then sure, that's contextual, and that's something you can look at, but it's still, I would submit, a four corners test. I don't mean to make light of how difficult it is for you to say what's in and what's out when you're determining what you're allowed to look at in terms of looking at relative context, but you can't do intent and effect, and you can't figure out what they're really trying to do here.
One of the, before we go to Mr. Sullivan, one of the interesting features of yesterday's panels when we were looking specifically at the Gansky ad, I think we had a witness who testified that it was express advocacy unless there, in context, there was a vote that was about to happen, and then it would look more like lobbying ads to them. So sometimes context ends up moving, you know, some reasonable people the other way. Mr. Sullivan.
Well, I agree. It's logical that the commission should be able to look at the context in order to understand the meaning of the words used within the four corners of the document. I think the context question, which raises so much concern, is material events outside of the document which address why was it said, what was the intended impact, what other events are going on in the campaign which this may relate to. Those context questions with respect to events or outside factors or impact or motivation, I think, are the kinds of contextual questions foreclosed by the decision. You always need to know what the context is, I think, in order to understand the meaning of the communication. But going beyond that, I think you go into the territory that the court, I think, attempted to restrict.
So to make it concrete, so if we had an ad where somebody was saying that an individual was not qualified to be commander-in-chief of the United States, and we took into consideration the person was actually running to be president of the United States, which is the same as commander-in-chief, that sort of a context would be, or the awareness of that sort of context would seem, under that analysis, to be appropriate in understanding the meaning of those words. Am I correct in
I think so.
Perceiving what you're saying?
I
okay.
think so.
Ms. Abick.
I would agree with what Mr. Sullivan said. My client, ATA, faced a similar situation out in California. They ran an ad during the energy crisis out there, and the tagline was Gray Outs from Gray Davis, and it ended with a light bulb clicking off. And Governor Davis argued that that should be interpreted as advocating his defeat, the clicking of the light bulb, when it just meant that his energy policies were causing everyone's power to go off.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. It strikes me that there's a reasonable interpretation other than in the Gray Davis ads, for sure.
The point we would just like to stress is that these latter ads that are being talked about, we view as electioneering communications, not independent expenditures, and that's where we would draw the distinction. Otherwise, there's no difference between an ad that qualifies as an electioneering communication and automatically qualifies as express advocacy. So you got to draw a line somewhere, or else the electioneering communication rules have really no meaning whatsoever. And so if you distinguish between the two, one is express advocacy, one's the functional equivalent, and the electioneering communication rules cover the functional equivalent, at least you have some meaning to the statute that's still on the books.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
this question is for you, Mr. Horsing, although I'd be glad to hear from the rest of the panel what you think about this, too. When Congress was debating S-1, the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, which they recently passed, both the House and the Senate specifically defeated amendments that would have required disclosure of the donors to organizations engaged in grassroots lobbying. Do you believe that those were defeated because Congress believed that that kind of disclosure was already required by FECA? And if you think that wasn't the reason, if you think that they defeated it for, you know, First Amendment reasons or others, is that a factor that we should take into account as the view of Congress on this issue when we are formulating this regulation?
First of all, I wrote, I was involved in this issue to some extent. I referred you to a piece I wrote called MLK, Grassroots Lobbyist, in National Review Online. So you're not going to find anyone more hostile to grassroots lobbying disclosure than me. And I'm very troubled by where the procedural posture of this case and where it leaves us and where things are. And I'm balancing case or controversy doctrine with, you know, congressional intent, with the other interpretations of other Supreme Court cases, and it's very difficult. Do I think you can infer from what Congress did in grassroots lobbying disclosure what it would probably do with regard to grassroots disclosure in the context of electioneering communications? Despite what Mark Elias said yesterday, that, you know, LDA and electioneering communications are different, I do think you can read something from that, just as you could and did read something about Congress's actions with regard to 527s during the 2004 rulemaking on political committee status. You noted that Congress required that they report, but not that they be political committees. And I think you're right to look at that and sort of put those two statutes side by side. But I do think there are cases in which the LDA and congressional intent is not going to match up with electioneering communications. At the end of the day, do I think Congress foresaw the snafu that would happen in WRTL? No, not for a minute. But I do believe you do have a provision that is facially valid. You have that from the McConnell Court, and you have no as-applied challenge to it. And the question is, when that's where you are, what do you do next? And that's a very difficult question for you. I'm just trying to tell you what I would do with it.
None of the other exemptions have a reporting requirement. The news media, entities that are exempt from electioneering communications under the news media exemption, for example, don't have to include disclosure statements in their ads, and they don't have to report their donors. They're permitted to run their ads because they're not electioneering communications. And I think when you determine that something's exempt from the definition of the electioneering communication, you're determining it's not an electioneering communication, and therefore, ipso facto, there shouldn't be any disclosure and reporting requirements with that. I think the authority under the statute to promulgate rules exempting certain communications from electioneering communications doesn't say anything about if you exempt them, they still have to report. Now, there's a question, of course, with respect to whether certain communications under this exemption would still pass O candidates and therefore maybe don't fall under this. But if you redefine PASO, I think you get past, or you actually define PASO, you get past that problem.
So Mr. Booz, you're saying, for the benefit of any reporters who are still here, that if we adopt alternative one in order to be perfectly fair, then we should extend the disclosure requirements to media organizations also.
Oh, I think if you were to do that, you'd have a firestorm on your hands. But sure, to be fair, why not?
That.
Okay, the mirthful regulators. The other questions? Vice Chairman Mason.
Ms. Abegg, you talked about the privacy interests of your donors and their desire for anonymity. Could you fill us in a little bit on that? Because, I mean, one of the things that bothers me, and I asked one of the counsels for the party committees who was here before, who was sort of suggesting that, you know, the incumbents really wanted to know who was behind these ads. And you've mentioned the Gray Davis suit, but I mean, are there? It would be useful if there are particular examples that you're aware of, and you may not be able to provide names of people who felt like their personal interests or business interests or political interests were threatened if they were disclosed as donors to particular organizations.
I have particular examples, but I can't share them. I mean, some of them are businessmen who are active in their communities or may be active in one political party, but there's an issue that is important to them, so they want to give to affect change on that issue, and they're afraid that if they do so, they're going to face harassment or reprisals from those and the other organizations with which they're associated. Some of them are just don't want their names known. They don't want any attention. They just want to do it anonymously and go
Margaret
about their
McIntyre.
Way.
Yeah, so, but just to try to fill it in a little bit, I appreciate it's precisely the people who would want to be anonymous who wouldn't want to be disclosed in this context either, but that you're aware of vis-a-vis your organizations, people who, and perhaps the California case, have interests before the state government and feel like those interests would be threatened. They care about the energy policy, but feel like their interests before the state government would be threatened if they were had their names identified with those ads.
Correct. And, I mean, it's a very real concern. They will talk to the client and just they want counsel's reassurance that their names are not going to be disclosed. That's before they even make the donation.
Mr. Vice Chairman, I can tell you, I've been on phone conversations. I can't reveal their nature, of course, but the gist is that people stop their activities because they heard about the disclosure aspect, simply stopped their plans. And they're pretty far along, and they even had the budget worked out. They said, oh, we've got to disclose.
And could you
end of activity.
Just elaborate on exactly concretely what their concern is?
Yes. Well, I'm not sure that I could, actually. I just know that when they heard disclosure, they were no longer interested in pursuing that issue that had a nexus to candidates. It was sort of in that gray line. And when they heard disclosure would be a possibility, they said no, thank you. I can give you two other examples if you want. And this is where disclosure is a good thing and it's required. K Street Project. Tom DeLay hauled people into his office and said, if you want to play in our revolution, you have to play by our rules. Another example is Sam Fox's confirmation hearing before the Senate when Senator Kerry used 527 disclosure to tee up Fox for his affiliation. And it shouldn't surprise you to know that Sam Fox did not speak much about his First Amendment rights of association in that hearing. He backed down. He called Kerry a hero. And he called the work of all 527s disgraceful, even though he'd given $50,000 to one. So do I doubt for a moment there's any chill that comes from this stuff? Not for a moment. Do I think there's any basis for compelling disclosure of grassroots lobbying activity? Not for a moment. I just think there is a serious lack in the posture of WRTL 2 with regard to Section 201 and the follow-up cases, which are WRTL 3 and Christian Civic League of Maine, that put this commission in a real pickle. And it's a difficult, difficult decision for you. I don't want to undermine that for a moment.
Other questions? Comments? General Counsel, Mr. Bursack. Mr. Sullivan, please.
I just want to add one brief point. There is a considerable body of case law dealing with the issue of disclosing the names of individuals who are members of civil rights and labor organizations. Clearly, a classic example of an individual who identifies as a member of a labor organization, particularly if they're involved in an activity which could be against their employer's interest, either forming a labor organization or taking a position on a public policy issue inconsistent with their employer's interests, could and actually are subject to discipline and reprisal in the workplace. And there's a fairly well-documented body of case law and experience that unions have attempting to protect their members who were identified as members of the union or supporters of the union's goals.
Very good. Any other closing thoughts from the panel? Please, Mr. Bowes.
I just have one brief issue that we have not discussed, and that's with respect to disclosure. What happens if you wholesale sell a bunch of DVDs to a wholesaler who's going to then resell those DVDs, and you sell them for $10,000? Citizens United were to sell them for $10,000. Is that a disclosable contribution under Alternative 1? Because it's a sale. How do you delineate between the sales revenue and the contributions that are going to pay for the ads? Because very clearly, the ads will be paid for revenues out of sales, and that's especially the case with respect to commercial entities.
Yeah. Problem for us in the definitional phase. Mr. Horstein, do you have a... You look like you're... No? Okay. I guess with that, anything from the council's office? Okay, with that, we will bring this hearing to a close. We are going to keep the record open for 4 days. That is until Wednesday of next week. There were a number of questions put to panelists at various stages of the last 2 days, and we had offered them an opportunity to respond in writing if they would like to submit additional information. And obviously, because the record is open, obviously anyone can submit additional information for our consideration in this matter. With that said, I bring this meeting to a close. Thank you very much.